My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Lily Ristagno. Lily, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Ed.
I don't have to welcome you to Portland because you live here.
Yes, I do.
Right. This is the title of your book is Short Fuse. Your last name is spelled R-I-S-T-A-G-N-O. And the book is about Carol Fugate and Charlie Starkweather. A person my age, I'm the same age, by the way, as Carol Fugate. We were born the same year.
Really?
Yeah. So that happened when I was in high school, 1957, 58, 59, around there. And it was quite a time to be alive because things were happening. Elvis was around and, you know, Blackboard Jungle came out and Rebel Without a Cause came out. And it seems to me that all of that is somehow connected to Charlie Starkweather in an odd way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us how you got interested in just for people who don't know, this is a pair of teenagers who in at least two states killed 10 people in 8 days in a spree killing. Tell us a little bit about that, about your interest in this.
Well, I was living in Missouri with a boyfriend who was going to college there, and on the weekends we would go to used bookstores, and this was I picked up a biography of Carol Fugate in this little bookstore in some tiny town, and I just immediately became fascinated with this story. And as I started to read the book, I started to draw images that came into my head while I was reading the story. And and I just ended up with this whole, at the time, I think it was 20 pictures that I ended up with that were I showed as an art exhibit. And by that time, I had actually moved to Nebraska to research the story more and actually go to some of these places.
That's commitment.
Yeah. There's not much to do out there.
Which is part of the problem for a kid like Charlie Starkweather.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Keep going. I'm sorry.
So I did this art exhibit, and it was a really interesting the way that it was received. People were, and there's a whole part in the end of the book about my personal experience of doing this in Nebraska. People were very, they were wary of someone exploring this as an art topic, and they were, some people thought it was really cool and interesting, but more often than not, people were, I'd say suspicious of, I don't know if they felt like it was, you know, exploiting their town.
They were embarrassed.
History.
I think even 50 years later, there's a certain embarrassment as having that hanging over your town is what people know it for.
Right. And in that, the city is Lincoln, Nebraska. It feels when you're there like that's the last big thing that happened there, even though, you know, it was in 1958. There's still enough people there that, like you, you know, they remember when this happened, or they remember being in grade school and getting pulled out of school in the middle of the day because the whole city was just thrown into a panic. I mean, nothing like this had ever happened almost anywhere, but certainly not in a sleepy little town in the Midwest.
Charlie Starkweather was, you know, I tried to do a little reading up on him before I talked to you so I could ask some intelligent questions here. He was widely considered in town to be a screw-up and not very bright. He had certain skills. He could probably do anything with a car that needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And he was also a crack shot with a rifle, mm-hmm. Two things that actually he needed while he was going on his murder spree. And he fell in love with a 13-year-old. He was about, what, 18, 19 at the time?
He was 19 and she was 14.
Yeah. So she was jailbait. Mm-hmm. She was an unhappy kid living with a stepfather and her mother and a half-sister, and she probably was a very resentful kid who thought that hanging out with a guy like Charlie Starkweather was exceedingly cool, yes?
Yes. Carol has been described as, at the time in 1958, a perfect assimilation of teen culture at that time. And she was, you know, a Bobby Soxer. She wore hair in a ponytail, rolled up jeans. And she was also pretty precocious for a 14-year-old. One of the things that Charlie has said about meeting her was, I never knowed a 14-year-old girl who knew so much. And she smoked and she swore. And I think that there was something in him with his sort of rebel without a cause. You know, he was definitely influenced by that movie and by the character that James Dean often played. I think that she, you know, really responded to this rebellious person.
She must have seemed sophisticated to him. I mean, he was such a bumpkin and a country boy, and he uneducated at that, poor reader, a poor writer. Some of his letters are quoted in here. He's an uneducated kid, and she must have seemed like something that fell out of a spaceship to him. I guess what I'm asking is, could this have happened without her? I mean, he made the first killing was without her, but he was trying to buy her a stuffed animal in a gas station in the middle of the night on credit, and the gas station attendant wouldn't give it to him. He was trying to buy something for Carol.
Yeah. Could this have happened without her? I actually, you know, I don't see Charlie Starkweather as having had a long life in any way. He was miserable. And one thing that Charlie and Carol did have in common was that they were both from this sort of lowest common denominator economically. I mean, there was, you know, he would look around and realize that he was, you know, he was never going to see the Yankees play. He was never going to eat in a fancy hotel. He was never going to have a fancy car. You know, there weren't any options. And then, as we said, you know, there wasn't much to do there. And he was a garbage man. That was his job, you know, picking up other people's garbage. And I think he was just really depressed, really angry, really resentful towards the world, and sort of just, I don't know if he was actually suicidal, but I would say that, you know, if I had to guess what would have happened to him if they wouldn't have met, I would say that he might have, crashed his car, sort of semi-accidentally, you know, drag racing, or, you know, had a shooting accident or something like that. I don't see her as like a corruptive force. Mm-hmm. I think it's more like two people that met and found this, just this sort of an anger that they had in common. And then it just took off from there, because when he met her, he fell really hard, and she seemed to reciprocate.
Do we know, you're just describing what I would consider to be, you know, class rage, you know, of being a lower than working class, really. He was, mm-hmm. he was what they would call the lumpen proletariat in Marxist terms.
Yeah.
But he also seemed to have psychological rage over and above anything. Maybe I'm putting too much into this, but when you direct your rage inward, you become suicidal. When you direct your rage outward, you become homicidal. Mm-hmm. In a way, I think that he turned his rage outward so he could impress Carol. Am I making too much of that?
Well, Charlie started getting in fights and developing a tough guy reputation practically since, I don't know, the second grade, maybe even kindergarten.
He had a speech impediment. The kids made fun of him.
Yeah, they made fun of him for that. He also had red hair, really bright red hair, so they made fun of him for that. He was bow-legged. They made fun of him for that. And, you know, he was a pretty happy and well-adjusted kid up until he went to public school. And he was, you know, at first hurt and then almost immediately after that, furious with the treatment that he perceived. And I mean, I would say that there was some, you know, sort of a persecution complex or whatever going on there too. But he was definitely acting out before he met her. And he had a reputation in the town as being pretty much the meanest kid, the meanest guy in town. Nobody wanted to tangle with him.
Yeah, every town's got one, too, at least one. Just parenthetically, Lincoln, Dick Cavett came from Lincoln, Nebraska, yeah. And I believe Johnny Carson came from Lincoln, Nebraska,
that's
although
right.
It might have been a small town east of Lincoln.
And Marlon Brando.
And Marlon Brando, that's right, yeah. It's hard to think of those three guys coming from there, but it's true. Actually, Johnny Carson seems like he might come from Nebraska. The other two guys, not so much.
Yeah.
So this poor gas station attendant, Robert Culvert, he was killed on December 1st, 1957, over the stuffed animal. Charlie went away and then came back a couple of nights later, bought something, went away the same night, came back a little while later and bought something, and then stuck a shotgun in the guy's face and took him out somewhere and blew his brains out. Then he told Carol, and Carol refused to believe him, that he might have robbed the store, which he did, but she refused to believe that that he had actually killed somebody. That's what leads me to think that, you know, he was out to impress her. But anyway, the next thing that happened is really the worst thing. He went to see her parents, who were mad at him because they thought that Carol was pregnant. Would you like to tell us what happened?
Yeah. Charlie actually went over to her parents' house that day with the intention of asking for her hand in marriage. And he had been trying to get in good with the parents for quite some time. He believed, and I mean, I'm not sure if this was truly going to happen or whether he just wanted to think so, but he believed that he was going out hunting that morning with Carol's stepfather. That's why he had the guns. This was not premeditated, the following events. It was really, you know, they had a fight, they had an argument. The stepfather, I think that right before Charlie came over that morning, they had just been discussing the fact that they thought that Carol Ann might be pregnant, which to this day, nobody has ever confirmed that.
She did not have a baby, we know that. Not with them, anyway.
I think so, yeah. And so they got into an argument when he showed up. The stepfather was already angry because he was, you know, having this discussion with Carol's mother. And he threw Charlie out of the house. The final insult was, as Charlie was leaving the property, the stepfather kicked Charlie really hard in the butt as he was, you know, pushing him out of the yard. And Charlie left the property for a little while, stewed, got himself really worked up, went back, demanded to be let in the house. And immediately Carol's mother started slapping him. And, you know, I don't know if at that point he had already thought about doing what he was going to do, because he did take the guns back to the house with him. But everything that happened after that just seems like it was really out of a rage, you know, and he killed both of Carol's parents and her stepsister, Betty Jean. And then
killed her with a knife. He was apparently quite adept with throwing a knife.
Threw a knife at her and killed her. I think she was 3. Now, you know, Carol hated her stepfather and she hated the stepsister. Carol had been the baby of the family until the stepsister was born.
Until Betty Jean came along. Yeah.
And
well, listen, let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Lily Ristagno, and the title of her book is Short Fuse. Tell us where in town you can buy the book.
You can buy this book at Guapo Comics, which is out on Foster, and at Excalibur Comics, and also at Floating World downtown. It's also available in San Francisco at Isotope Comics, And it can be ordered off of my website.
And you would like people to do that?
I would love it if they did that.
Yeah, give us your website.
It is all one word, shortfusethebook.info.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What this is really tough even to think about. After Charlie killed Carol's family, what happened?
Well, not much. For about a week, they stayed in the house. Charlie did move the bodies out into the... Carol's family was so poor, they actually still had an outhouse in 1958. He moved the bodies out to the outhouse, and then he and Carol just lived it up in the house. They read comic books. He would go to the store periodically and stock up on candy and junk food that, you know, she wasn't ever allowed to eat. And had a lot of sex all over the house. And, you know, they just lived this, the perfect teenage fantasy of what you do when your parents are, you know, out of town, only they weren't coming back.
Yes. Tell us about the note on the door.
Carol wrote a note. This was in her handwriting. She stuck it on the front door, and the note said, sort of really poorly spelled, it said, "Stay away. Everyone is sick with the flu." And the reason that she did that was because she came from a big family, and her various relatives that lived around Lincoln stopped by frequently. And she had been, you know, she would answer the door and sort of do whatever she could to not let whoever came by in. And then she put up this note, and the relatives didn't start to get suspicious for a few days, but then, you know, they hadn't heard anything from the family, and so that was the beginning of, you know, when they started to go to the police and ask them to look in on the situation. The police actually did come to the house, and here's, you know, this little girl looking all pale and telling them that the family just had a really bad case of the flu, and the police were satisfied with that.
Well, the alternative that turned out to be was unthinkable.
Right.
Yeah. Pictures of Carol show a sullen little girl, mm-hmm. almost always wearing a headscarf. You know, when I think of pictures of Carol Fugate, she's always got this babushka tied around her head. Mm-hmm. What did you make of that? Did you ever think, I mean, I don't know if there's any significance in it. It just seems to me my picture of her.
Oh, well, I'd say that probably most of the pictures that you've seen were taken either outdoors or, you know, just coming in from outdoors. And Nebraska is always really windy. So
if you want to keep your hair together.
Yeah, I think that's all I would see in that. An interesting thing about Carol's hairstyle is that when they were arrested, Carol, as I said, she wore her hair in a ponytail, and she looked, you know, she looked sullen, and maybe she was a little precocious, but she pretty much didn't look any older than, I don't know, 15. After she was arrested, and while she was in custody, just before her first court date, they cut her hair in prison. They gave her a very short hairstyle. And her attorneys insisted later that that turned the jury against her because she looked so much older and sort of, you know, harder.
Yeah. She had a pretty hard look on her face anyway. They took off from Lincoln after the cops got wise, or after they thought the heat was on. Tell us what they did. Let me tell you why I'm asking this. This was the time when the phrase juvenile delinquency was coming into American vocabulary. People were starting to be terrified of their children. You heard stories about rumbles in New York, about kids killing each other with switchblades. There were movies like Blackboard Jungle and Rebel Without a Cause. It seemed as though the kids were out of control and nobody really knew what to do with them. And the the events that followed the murder of Carol's family seem to fall in with that idea in a peculiarly Midwestern way, because it's all open spaces. It's not a bunch of kids in a ghetto in New York killing each other. It's vast amount of travel and stolen automobiles. Yes?
Yes. Although I would say that there was probably a lot less of that sort of fear of one's teenage children in a place like Lincoln, Nebraska, than in inner city. I mean, I do think for the most part that kids still obeyed their parents and, you know.
Which makes this even more horrifying, of course.
Right. Yeah. And for instance, two of their victims after they left Lincoln were a strange sort of a mirror of themselves, this other teenage couple.
One named Carol King, oddly. Yeah.
Carol King and Bob Jensen, mm-hmm. who were on a date, and these kids were like honor students. I think one of them was class valedictorian. I mean, they were like the
good mirror image of
good
Charlie
image.
And Carol. Yeah.
Yeah. And which had to rankle them somehow, because, you know, here were these kids that were living this life that they would never have, and, you know, well-dressed, nice car, out on a Saturday night, sort of, you know, where their parents knew they were out together and they would be home by a decent time. And that was, in my mind, the most brutal murder of all the murders that they committed, and the one that has the most mystery around it, because the female of the couple, Carol King, she was found in a cellar. They have tornado cellars all over the Midwest and especially in Nebraska. She was found in the bottom of this tornado cellar, and she had been sexually mutilated. And Charlie always insisted that it was Carol that had done that part. Not that she killed her, but that she went in after he came up from the tornado cellar after having shot this girl. And that Carol was jealous and maybe suspected him of some kind of creepy hanky-panky thing, and that she went in there and that he didn't know about the mutilation until later after he was arrested. And that's never been confirmed or denied.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to go too far, and we have, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 minutes left in the interview without talking about the pictures in here, because you're a wonderful artist. And what's the medium here? I see something that looks like pencil and maybe something that looks like watercolor. What were the media that you used for these pictures?
Well, you know, I did these over a long period of time, and you know, I never had any money, and I haven't been formally trained as an artist, and I have to say that I just pretty much used whatever I could get my hands on. I think the majority of these, I would say that I sketched in pencil and then went back over with pen and ink or brush and ink. And then, yeah, the ones that are colored are mostly watercolors, but some of them also will have, you know, some part of the picture is colored pencil or even crayon. There's one picture in here that is done entirely in cutout paper.
Collage.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Huh? Yeah. What you have is blocks of text, and then you have these illustrations, some of which have captions, handwritten captions on them. Are there a lot more of these pictures, and you chose these for the book, or is this the total number of pictures you came up with for the story?
No, there's a few more. I'd say there's probably about 10 or 15 that didn't get used.
How did the pictures that you drew suggest themselves to you? I mean, how did you choose the scenes that you illustrated?
Well, some of these are, a lot of these are actually from photographs, although not necessarily photographs of Charlie and Carol. I've, you know, been interested in photography, and particularly black and white photography, for a long time. And sometimes I would just check a book out of the library that was just like photos of the 1950s and sketch a photo from that and then turn the people in the picture into the characters in the story. But I'd say about a third of these are taken from photos that were in the Nebraska State Archives. They were actually evidence because when they were preparing to make their getaway from Lincoln, they just, Carol packed just strange things. Still in the end, she was 14. You know, she packed her stuffed animals, a bathing suit, bizarrely, and a bunch of snapshots of herself and her family and pictures of her and Charlie. And these snapshots were in her purse when they were apprehended. And so they became crime scene evidence, and they now live in the Nebraska State Archives, which I got access to for this project. So a lot of these are pictures that have never been seen by the public.
Charlie Starkweather was executed on June 25th of 59. He was 20 or 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Carol Fugate was sentenced to life in prison, and she got out after 17 years. And I was able to find the last place she's living is in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
outside of Lansing somewhere, and is allegedly a nurse's aide, although nobody is able to confirm or deny that. She took a lie detector test on national television and passed it.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know about that.
You can find it online if you, all you have to do is Google her name. But I think by that time she had so convinced herself that she was innocent and that Charlie had done all the murders that she could have passed any lie detector test with flying colors.
Yeah.
One other thing. At the very end, when Charlie was on trial, he felt that Carol had betrayed him. Do you know about this?
Yeah, it's interesting because originally, you know, still in the flesh of first love, he went to great lengths to protect her and, you know, said over and over again to the police and in court that Carol had done nothing and that he had committed all the crimes. Although he did leave some graffiti in a jail cell that implicated her by, it was like their names together in a heart, and then it said, you know, their name and then like a tally mark next to it to be presumed that was how many people that they had each killed.
Mm-hmm.
And later, when I'm not sure what changed his mind about this, but I think it might have had to do with the fact that she wouldn't see him or have any kind of contact with him or write him a letter or anything. The one thing she did do was write a note saying that she didn't want to see him anymore because she was afraid of what she might do, which is very mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll never know what she might or might not have done. He became angry at some point and started to spill his guts about all Carol's participation. And when he was, the story goes that when he was in the electric chair, he said that Carol should have been sitting in his lap.
Great line.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Lily Ristagno. She's the author of Short Fuse, about Charlie Starkweather and Carol Fugate and their murder spree across the Midwest in the late 50s. Give us again your website.
The website is shortfusethebook.info.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ed. It's been a pleasure.